everybody. This is the Ramble Redhead Show, and today is part two of the interview with Rich Merritt. As you well know, he is a very popular author, and he's written a book called Secrets of a Gay Marine Porn Star. And I had the luxury of having him on the program. And you, if you had listened to part one, you got all the way up to his life growing up in South Carolina, as well as how he went into the Marines. And then we got right near the end of the show is where we were talking about how he had started to get into basically into porn. And what I'd like to do is we'll go from there. And what I'd like to do is thank Rich again for being a part of the program. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Very good. And what I wanted to do is just take off where we left off on the first part. And if you could just – so at the time you were doing your videos, you said that you did about eight of them at the time. And so what happened after you did those eight? What happened?
Well, I was probably would have kept doing them because, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I was feeling a lot of mixed emotions about it. I was feeling some guilt about being on active duty in the Marines. First of all, I'm not supposed to be gay. Definitely not supposed to be on pornos. But then after the video would end and I would go back, a week or so later, I would get a call from a producer, hey, we got another shoot going on. Would you like to be in it? And you just get this adrenaline rush, and it's a validation thing, and, you know, hey, somebody thinks I'm good looking, they're even willing to pay me for it, and a lot of guys, you know, feel the need for that, and I certainly did too. And I just kept saying yes, and...
Well,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. If you had something to add, go ahead. I just had another question. Did you have anything else you wanted to add to that?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, obviously, you know, if you know, most gay men obviously, you know, do like porn, and if they admit that they don't, they're probably lying. But anyway, but I'm sorry?
No, you're exactly right, and I should probably restate that. I didn't really have any guilt about doing the porn.
Yeah.
That was maybe some residual from my Baptist days, who knows.
Right.
But the guilt, I think, was I was doing something that was against Marine Corps regulations. Now, sodomy is against Marine Corps regulations, and that's a separate issue. But porn was, in my mind, I guess I would come away from it, and I would think, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
And that's where it was coming from. But you're right. Cause, you know, even today, people, when I get, you know, when I get certain reactions from certain people, I think, you know, it's porn is, you know, guys having sex, young, good-looking guys getting paid to have sex. What's wrong with that? There's no, you know, no one's being forced to do it. Maybe being exploited, perhaps, you know, the pay for the guys is very little. But, if, you know, hey, if you're a free market supply and demand type of person, that's what the market rate is.
Right.
So, you know, that's a whole separate issue.
So at the time you were given $500 to film it for basically 3 hours.
Yeah, and it gets a little more than that. Like, they would, after I did a couple of those shoots in Dirk Yates' studio, he had a couple of producers in there for the second one, and they liked what they saw, so they put me in a higher budget. You know, I got $700 or $800 and a trip to the Russian River, and they put us up in a hotel room and fed it. You know, just like an on-location shoot.
Right.
And, so that was a little bit more money, and you know, that's like anything else. You're worth what someone is willing to pay you.
Right.
And if you perform well and you do what you're told, and you know, you make more money. So that's what was happening. But after my seventh video, I went to this party, a lesbian beach party in Newport Beach, California, and happened to. There were a few guys there, a few military guys, and then one of my Navy friends, Jim, had brought some friends, and one of those was a guy in the book, and the name that I give him is Brandon. And from that day on, Brandon and I spent the next 7 years together.
Wow.
And I told him on our second date that I had done porn and that I had one more commitment. He didn't believe me, I don't think. I had to tell him two or three more times that I never did another video. The week after we met, I had one more video to do. After that, I never did another.
Well, before you get into about Brandon, I was just curious. You know, obviously, there's, like you mentioned earlier, there's kind of a stigma about doing porn. And I was just wondering, did you feel that a lot from the people that did know about it or knew about you, or did you keep it pretty hush-hush?
I kept it pretty hush-hush, but I started getting phone calls probably about 7 or 8 months after my first video. They started coming out, you know, and friends started calling. And, of course, once one friend knows, they all know. And most of my close friends just kind of shook their heads and thought, you know, this is Rich being stupid and risky, but they didn't really think anything about it. At least not to me, they didn't. They're good guys. I know people beyond that inner circle of friends, you know, you can tell, you know, once they know, there's, I've gotten a few, especially since the book has come out, I've gotten a lot of reactions, which by this point, it just bounces off my back. I don't really care. But yeah, you get that reaction.
Yeah, because I was just wondering, because I've read some other stories in the past about that type, you know, having that type of as a career, and obviously there's a, you know, big stigma. I mean, I remember when, Linda Lovelace, when she had died and her daughter had said, well, I wish my mother could be remembered other than her porn career. And, you know, but, you know, obviously she was very famous in Deep Throat and that kind of thing. So I was just wondering if you had, you know, similar feelings about, you know, hesitating about telling people or, you know, that kind of thing. But,
in the beginning, definitely, you know, after I did it, it was one of those, once I met Brandon and got out of it, then I thought, God, what the hell was I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Putting myself at risk like this, and I'm going to law school. I'm going to be working at one of the top law firms in the country. You know, who knows what? Now I've got this thing in the past. That created a lot of anxiety. That's what led up to some other things later that I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing, because, you know, you always hear about, you know, things happening where people did something when they were younger, and then years later it comes out, you know, to, you know, maybe to haunt you in a way. But, I certainly hope that obviously hasn't happened. Hopefully that hasn't happened to you. So getting to Brandon then. So obviously you met him at this party, and how old were you at that point?
I was 27, and he was 33.
Okay.
He's just a wonderful person, and exactly, we needed each other very much at that time, and we fell in love almost right from the start, and I still had 3 years left on active duty.
Wow.
So we would see each other on the weekends, almost every weekend, and then we would take vacations together,
mm-hmm.
You know, talk on the phone every evening, and we kind of became this Ozzy and Harriet gay couple in Orange County, California.
Okay.
We had the dog. You know, it was a really nice life. And about what happened at this time, as I was settling down, I started writing this column in the Navy Times. And I was selected to write an op-ed piece. And they wanted me to write under a pseudonym because they wanted an active duty person who could be open and frank about things.
Okay.
In the military, you can't just speak your mind, and so this gave me a way to do that. And a lot of the columns I wrote were very controversial.
Like what?
They said pick a fake name, and so I picked my boyfriend's dog's name, and that was Buster Pittman.
Buster Piffin?
Pittman.
Pittman.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's what I wrote for 2 years. I had every other week I had a column in. And finally, in late 97, I was able to get a column in challenging Don't Ask, Don't Tell, saying that this policy should be repealed and gays and lesbians will have to serve openly.
Oh, okay, back up. So this was a column for what again?
It was the Navy Times, which is a civilian-owned newspaper that's distributed all over the military.
And what were some of the topics, other than the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, what did you cover that were controversial?
One of the topics that I wrote about was that women should be allowed to serve in combat if they meet the same standards that men can meet. You know, it's ridiculous just to bar women from combat jobs just because they're women. I think that's ridiculous.
Right.
And, of course, that caused, you know, I got a lot of negative publicity from that. And then one of the ones that I got even more bad letters and stuff have been about my Don't Ask, Don't Tell piece was, at the time, in fact, I think still, in the military, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, to commit adultery is a felony.
Right.
And this was during the Clinton years, and the Clinton impeachment scandal was going on, and so there was this movement in the military to say, in the Department of Defense, to say, let's make this a misdemeanor instead of a felony. Well, the Marine Corps came back and said, no, we need to keep this a felony because, you know, if we don't, if a Marine can't be trusted to be faithful to his wife, how can he be trusted in other ways? And I think it's ridiculous what a person does in their personal life is their own business.
Right.
Not the military. So I wrote a column saying, you know, let this go to a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And I got tons of hate mail for that.
Wow. So I was just curious, you know, here you have a Navy, you know, newspaper that was wanting you to write columns that were controversial. You think that it would be more of the conservative, you know, the basic stories. You think that I was just curious, how did you get associated with that and, you know, what made them want to do that? I mean, I was just curious because, you know, I know that I read some other publications like that and I just find it amazing that they would even, you know, push that button per se.
Well, they are owned by Gannett, which at the time, or they were owned by Gannett at the time, which also owned USA Today. So, you know, they're still a conservative company, but, you know, they try to be a little balanced. They're not owned by the Pentagon. I mean, there are some military-owned papers that are just nothing but mouthpieces for what the military wants to put out. This was a little different than that, and there was a guy who had been writing the column for as long as I can remember that was just, you know, ultra-right-wing, typical what you think of, and it just made me mad.
Mm-hmm.
And when they brought me in, they also brought in another guy. And so we would rotate. And he would do stereotypical military, conservative, right-wing columns, and it actually just kind of turned, it just so happened that we kind of fell into this liberal-conservative thing, which was fine with me because I was probably the most liberal officer in the Marines. And so that's why it worked out really well. I think they liked it.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, I was just curious, you know, have you always been doing a lot of writing in the past? I mean, prior to this?
I've always loved to write. That's been one of my passions. When I was in high school, I wrote a play. When I look at it now, it's ridiculous because it's so campy.
Right.
And, of course, back then I thought I was straight. But it was this version of... it was kind of like a modern version of Romeo and Juliet meets West Side Story meets, you know, billionaire families in Manhattan feuding across Central Park type of thing.
Right.
But I've always loved to write. It's always been my passion.
Well, cool. Well, I love to write, too, and I think it's... I just love to talk to other people that are writers because you get their creative process and what they go through and, you know, and their way of writing and how they... you know, analyze it and how they critique themselves. And I mean, I just think it's amazing. It's just another creative process. And that's what I love about like the podcast and, you know, and the blog, you know, those all play together, I think. And you, and it's just amazing how you can really connect with people when you do that. And,
oh, yeah. And that's what I love most about this. I started a group on Yahoo that as people email me, I ask them if they want to join the group. And so far we've got, you know, over 50 members and, these are people who have the same, because, you know, I noticed people were writing me a lot of the same stuff. They read the book and they connected with it emotionally, which is exactly what I wanted. But I thought, well, why should I keep all this, you know, sharing and experience and strength to myself and share it with each other? And so that's what we've got going now. My next book is also going to be, I'm actually editing an anthology of essays that other people are writing. And so I'm able to give a voice or an outlet to other writers so that, you know, they can keep on giving back, I guess, that way, and plus it's still my book, so it's,
well, what,
writing, I mean, with Terry Fabry, who's another editor.
Yeah, well, is it, what, the Yahoo group again, what is it called?
It's just Rich Merritt at, if you go to my website, like you've already given the address, actually, you haven't given it yet, in this podcast.
Okay, go ahead.
My website, there's a link on it where they can join.
Okay. You mean enlist the club?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Well, just for the sake of our listeners, again, I just want to clarify the website that Rich is talking about is www.richmerritt.com, and it's RichMerritt.com. And he has a lot of great information on here. He's got pictures. He's got talks about his book. It's got a lot of rave reviews. So, I mean, it's just incredible. So I'm really... really excited about having you on the program. And well, getting back to the, you know, obviously the writing and the newspaper article. So obviously you said you got a lot of reaction to that, you know, to that article about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So did you do any follow-up articles on that? Did anything happen because of the response, or did they learn?
Pretty much everything else that happened because of that, because about that time, there was a writer for the New York Times Magazine who was looking to do a story about what life under Don't Ask, Don't Tell was like.
Mm-hmm.
And she contacted the Service Members Legal Defense Network, and SLDN is an organization out of Washington that helps men and women in the military who are facing any problem with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Right.
And they put her in, they had noticed in that article. I met the co-director at Fundraiser, and right after that is when they put the New York Times Magazine writer in touch with me. So I went from that article in the Times getting the attention of SLDN, which put me in touch with the New York Times Magazine. Well, the New York Times Magazine story started happening, and I helped the writer with meeting people. I introduced her to we had a dinner with about a dozen of my military friends, gay and lesbian military friends, in San Diego, so she got a lot of source material for her story that way. And then other people along the way I introduced her to.
Mm-hmm.
She also mentioned something about photographs. Well, of course, we would talk to her anonymously, but there weren't a whole lot of us who were willing to have our photographs taken. At this point, I had already submitted my resignation to get out of the Marines. I was still on active duty, but I was going to be getting out soon. I was being a little bolder than most. And I told her that, you know, they could take a photograph of me if they wanted to. Well, they photographed about three of us, and it was a picture where the three of us in our dress blue uniforms are lined up in a row. You can't see our faces. But I just thought that was the picture that was going to be used. Well, when the magazine came out in June of 1998, the cover was of just me, and the article pretty much focused on me. They never gave my name, they never said any specifically identifying information, but if you pieced it all together, it was obvious that it was me. And anyone who knew me who read the article would think, oh, this is Rich Merritt. So I still had 6 weeks on active duty. My Italian commander called me in and said, you know, there are a lot of people who think this is you. I'm not going to ask if this is you. Quite frankly, I don't give a damn if this is you, because whoever this is did not violate Don't Tell. They never gave their name. And that's what I counted on. Well, he said, if anyone gives you any problem, or if you, I think what he was afraid of is that I was going to get the shit beat out of me. And that didn't happen. So he did tell me, look, come and talk to me if you have a problem. And that was pretty much it. The next 6 weeks went by. It was a very nervous time for me.
Yeah.
But I was honorably discharged, and because I had resigned at the end of my time to get out and go to law school.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm looking at your website, and I'm looking at the pictures right now, and I'm seeing the cover of the New York Times where it shows you, and you're, like, saluting and you're covering your face, and then the next one is the one that you said had the three of you together, and you're, like, saluting, and, you again, all the faces are covered. Well, did you go very detailed about you and your story in that article? I mean, how did everybody assume that it was you?
Yeah, it's an 8,000-word story.
Okay.
And she mentions, well, first of all, I was a captain. I was a commanding officer. I had been a general's aide, and I was on the West Coast. I was from the South, from a religious family, and my initials are. And based on that information alone, that narrows it down to about 10 people.
Oh, okay.
So people who knew me, that, I mean, in that article, see, I didn't know how big of a deal the New York Times magazine was. I mean, I was on the West Coast. The LA Times has a magazine. Nobody ever reads it.
Right.
But, you know, I thought it was going to be like the Parade magazine or something.
Right.
Well, when it came out, I mean, that got emailed around the world. So, it was a really big deal. In fact, the New York Times had sent the Pentagon a copy, and it was emailed to the general, and they emailed it to the lieutenant colonel. And so, it was, I mean, even before the article came out, they knew it was me.
Wow. Well, that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking. I was kind of going through my days in the pain. About this time also, I told the co-chair of the organization, the Service Members Legal Defense Network, my friend, this is what I told him about the porn. And, of course, he freaked out.
Right.
And look, if they figure out this is you, they're going to come after you, they're going to find out about the porn, you're going to get found out right before you get out. So I took anything out of, and he's also a lawyer now, former Marine. So I took everything out of my apartment and took it up to his house, and he was my lawyer. And if anybody had come into my apartment, they would think I had absolutely no life at all because I took all my books and photographs and computer and everything up to his house.
Wow. So how long did that process take from beginning to end that when you finally felt, okay, it's over, I can move on and I can go on?
Well, it kind of came in phases because I got out of the Marines on a Monday and then I started law school on Friday, but I was technically still in the Marines. I was just on terminal leave. I still had leave, vacation days saved up.
Right.
So I was still kind of in this gray area. And interestingly enough, this is when a writer for The Advocate contacted me. He said, hey, I've heard this is you. I would like to do a story identifying you. And I said, once I get out of the Marines completely discharged at the end of the year, then we can do the story. And so that's what happened. At the end of that year, they did the story on me in The Advocate. It was, you know, page 58. This is Rich Merritt. This is who was in the Times. And you know, it ran, the issue was the one that was, George Michael was on the cover because he had just been arrested for beating off in the park.
Right.
So that's what I was on the cover of. Well, before that story came out, since that gave my name, this is when I decided I needed to come out to my parents. And so I wrote them a letter and told them that I'm gay and that there was going to be some press about it, and they may hear. I didn't want them to write about this that way. So I sent them this letter and waited, and 2 weeks later, which is right after Christmas, they called me, and, you know, my dad said, son, we love you, but we're Christians, and we just can't accept this sort of thing. And of course, my mom is sobbing in the background, going, how could you choose to do this to me?
Wow.
Which is exactly the reaction I had anticipated. And I just said, well, like I said in the letter, it's I don't believe that God makes mistakes. And I finally realized that, and I accepted myself for who I am, and I'm not going to live a lie. I'm going to live honestly and openly. So
wow.
That was pretty much the last time we talked about it.
And how old were you then?
I was about 30, I think it was 30, 31 at this point.
Okay, so, well, I was just curious, why did you decide to tell them in a letter versus, like, on the phone if you couldn't be there in person?
I'm more of a writer. I'm not much of a phone person. And I knew my mom, when she first heard it, was going to say horrible, unforgivable things. I didn't want to hear them.
Right.
So I just decided to write them a letter.
Okay.
I think it was the right choice.
Okay, so how have they been since then?
Well, my dad passed away about a year ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And that's a long that the book kind of he starts going downhill physically, and so things happen there. And my mom, with all that's happened in our family, it just kind of went by the on the back burner for a long time. So
mm-hmm.
we just we're not nearly as close as we used to be, and we just it's just one of the things we don't talk about.
Right. Did you have brothers and sisters as well?
I have one younger brother. He's 35. He's in Maryland.
Okay. And how was his reaction?
His reaction is he's a kind of quiet, introverted type person. But he's you know he came out to California several times and stayed with Brandon and me and met my friends and you know hung out with us. So if he has any problem with it, he doesn't demonstrate it.
Okay. Well, good. Okay. So all this was going on. The article comes out. Then you did the New York Times article. Then you did the Advocate, and then you did another article with the Advocate. Was it February of 1999? Is that right? Where you talked about?
I didn't do that article. What happened was when the first article came out a few days later. The Advocate called me and said we were contacted by one of our readers who said he's met you before, and he had, and he said that you. Been in pornographic videos. Is this true? And of course, I freaked out and called my lawyer friend, and he said, "Don't say anything. We'll get back with you." And SLDN got back with me and said, "Don't say anything, and we have nothing to do with this." And everybody was starting to backpedal from me, so I called the Advocate back and said, "I don't understand why you would do a story about this. It's not going to help anybody if it's true, and if it's not true, you're going to get sued for libel." But that was the stupidest thing in the world I could have said, because of course that's the quote that went in there.
Oh, wow.
Me. A month later they did this cover story, the Marine who did gay porn. I felt like and still feel like it was a pretty, well not slanderous because it's true, but I thought it was a very negatively slanted article. And for many years after I didn't really care for the Advocate. And it's kind of a hypocritical thing too, because they do publish pornographic magazines.
Yeah.
The article makes it sound like there's something bad about porn, and this is the Advocate. So.
Yeah. Well, I find it a bit hypocritical too. I mean, one of the things they talk about is, you know, sex and the phone lines, the porn. I mean, they got all that stuff, but then the next minute they make it sound like it's horrible, and then the next minute that's what they're advertising for, and you know, I think all of the gay magazines in some way, I think it's just amazing. I mean, even Men's Health magazine. I mean, come on, look at any Men's Health magazine and look in the back. They've got more gay ads than some, you know, other magazines. It just amazes me. And they're supposed to be going out to the straight community. But that's my little pet peeve, too. I just find it hypocritical to judge people for who they are and what they want to do. And, I mean, it's like anything else. You make the choice. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's like you said earlier, it's your life. You know, you make that choice. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I don't know. I it just amazes me that people are so judgmental when it comes to stuff like that. But I don't know. I just think it's wrong. But so when all that happened, so what were you thinking at that time when all this stuff was happening and the article comes out? What was your response? Did you write back? Did they try to follow up at all? Did they give you any opportunity to speak on your behalf?
Oh no, nothing like that. I mean, they had given me to be fair to the Advocate, they had given me the opportunity initially, and I should have. I had an instinct that said talk to them then. Looking back, that's what I should have done, because they're going to do the story, and if I cooperate with them, maybe I have some influence over it.
Mm-hmm.
But by not saying anything, I gave away any control or any influence I might have had. But after the story, of course, I was in my first year of law school, which is arguably one of the toughest times of a person's life, and I reacted to this by the same way I'd reacted to a lot of things. I just focused on my studies, and I got the highest grades in my educational career that semester, just because that's all I focused on.
Right.
But at this time, something was happening. I was noticing more and more guys and more of my friends I'd had starting to go to search parties, starting to go to the white party, you know, the big parties in New Orleans and Montreal and Miami. And I was, the Advocate story really plunged me into this deep depression. And I was no longer in the Marines. I was no longer getting tested for drugs. And I kind of reached this point, and I said, well, let me see what this drug ecstasy is like. Everyone's talking about it, and so I went to the white party in 99 and tried it for the first time, and wow, I had discovered the cure for everything.
Wow.
One little pill, and so, you know, the first year after that, I probably tried ecstasy, did ecstasy, you know, 5 or 6 times, and it wasn't really a problem. But at the end of that year, at the end of 99, one of my best friends from law school committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And he had been, I was in my second year of law school, he had been like my mentor. Alan, he's a total sweetheart and came from the same background, kind of fundamentalist Christian. You know, he never was able to reconcile that with being gay, and that really just, it was just like one more thing, and so I started using more drugs, and of course, at this point, you know, like any drug, this is all diminishing returns or rise, and it's not as effective, and so I wanted to try something more, and eventually, you know, that led to crystal meth.
Oh, wow.
And over a period of, you know, a couple of years, I was using crystal meth and going to more parties, and instead of just going to one party, you know, the white party, you go to the pre-party and the after-party and the morning after-party, you know, they can cram 10 parties into one weekend.
Wow.
And if you use the right drugs and get it just so, you can go to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You never even have to come down until the following week.
Were you still with Brandon at that time?
Yeah, that was a big part of the problem. I viewed Brandon, he knew some of what was going on. He didn't know other things. And I was not being faithful to him at this time.
Oh, you weren't?
And that was, you know, that was something that I was starting to feel really guilty about. And, of course, the guilt leads to more depression, which leads to more drug use, which leads to, you're caught up in this vicious cycle. And at any point in time, you know, I could have chosen to reach out for help, but I did not. So I take full responsibility for what was happening and what I was doing.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, because I feel like Ryan Seacrest from American Idol, I just feel like what we'll do, we'll be right back after this message. But we're over the 32-minute mark again, and I'd just like to take a little break. But please hold that thought. But what I'd like to do is, again, thank all my wonderful listeners for being part of the program. Again, you can go to my website at rambleredhead.blogspot.com. You can send me an email at rambleredhead@gmail.com. And don't forget to make sure that you check out Rich's website, which is Rich Merritt, RichMerritt.com. And also check out his site and check out his book. And you can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Inside Out Book Club. And you can find all the information not only on his site, but I also have all the links on my site as well. So keep on listening to the Ramble Redhead. And we will continue with part 3 with Rich very, very soon. So stay tuned, and thank you for being a big part of the Ramble Redhead show.